Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast, and today I have as my guest Mr. Simon Lovell. Hi there, Simon.
Hey, Scott, you seem to have me on this thing every other week. Are you running out of guests?
Well, you're one of the most popular people, I think, that we seem to get a lot of hits. People want to know what's up with Simon. You know, I mean, you've been on the real magic thing for Cosmo for a long time. I know, working over there in Fantasma, that was always one of the favorite segments.
Yeah, actually, I don't work with Fantasma anymore. We're told nothing bad between us, I think. It's just that things happen, and they've gone one way, I've gone the other way. But I still work with Cosmo and the guys, and obviously if Fantasma ever need anything from me, we always have a chat and stuff like that. And Life moves on, my friend.
Well, that's true. That's true. And so I know that, again, a lot of the tips and things that you had given that were on the Real Magic, what was the column called, I think, as Simon Says or something? What was it?
I think now we're doing one called Ask Simon, where people mm-hmm. send in questions, and if their question is chosen and answered on the DVD thing, then they get a prize of some free stuff from Cosmo. I'm fairly sure he's sending them old underpants and odd socks and things, but it's a prize.
It's a prize. Yeah, it would be a surprise. I was expecting something cool, and I got some dirty underpants.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly wouldn't want any of Cosmo's socks, put it that way.
And so that is continuing then as well. And let me ask, as far as having the question sent in, as I recall, like whenever that, Joni Spina had a column in Magic Magazine, for an example, that she was soliciting videos and things that she could critique and then have something to write about. And there have been some other columns that people will try to solicit, questions, and people seem to be a little bit reluctant. Yeah. Do you have problems? I mean, I'm sure that's the one thing that you, I mean, you're anxious to answer questions, but do you get a lot of questions?
They certainly get enough, because it comes up once every other month, I think. So we actually only need 6 or 7 questions a year.
Yeah.
So it's not that tough to get them. But I totally understand what you say, you know, the people, especially if you have a reputation for being quite blunt and saying what you think, which for some strange reason I seem to have a bit of that reputation. And they do get a bit frightened about writing in case they look stupid or feel foolish or whatever, but I will advise, I'd certainly tell all of your podcasters out there that I certainly don't treat anything as being foolish or stupid at all. I take every question as seriously as any other.
Now, what kind of questions would you solicit? I mean, you're looking to have people ask you about, I don't even know what kind of questions to ask. What do people normally ask you?
I actually prefer questions more about the theory presentation, grandiose, the larger picture questions, rather than just what's the best double lift or what's the best second deal,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. Because those kind of questions really are questions you should answer yourself.
So
if you want to do a double lift, you study all the double lifts and look at which one is the best one for you, because I can't tell you which is the best one for you. I can tell you which is the best one for me, but that may not be the right one for you.
So a question might be something kind of like, what's the best way to practice, or how do I set aside...
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Or what do you think of mentalism in today's world, or, one question coming up, I believe, or if it hasn't gone out already, was somebody wrote in quite amusingly to me and said, what do you think of vulgarity in performance, and does it have a place? You know, those kind of questions are much more interesting to answer because they give you a nice scope to cover all sorts of areas of things,
mm-hmm.
rather than just saying, what's the best part? Mine. Thank you. Good night.
Yeah, more of a broad platform. Certainly, you can go in different directions with something, you know, kind of like that.
Yeah, and it's great fun to do. You know, Mark and Phoebe and Cosmo are all great people. And we actually filmed, I shouldn't really tell you this, but we filmed the entire year in one afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they come down to, we actually film it down at a little local watering hole of mine. And they come down and we do 6 or 7 questions one after the other. And then we just have some nice food, a couple of drinks, and we all part and off they go into the wild blue yonder.
I think I know which watering hole you're talking about. I've been with you there a few times.
Oh, you've been with me at many watering holes, Scott.
But I know what you're talking about as far as recording that. When Banachek and I had the series for a couple of years that...
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you did the mentalism thing with him there, didn't you?
Yes, and we recorded that here in my sitting room, in my home. And so we would do two or three at a time to send in. And... Yeah, I know that we've had several people in requests that kind of continue. Certainly, Banachek has a lot to offer, but the problem is nowadays, of course, him working with Chris Angel and other projects that he's working with that certainly takes him in different directions. So it's kind of hard to get him to sit down for a while to kind of focus and have something prepared to talk about. But
sure, I mean, that's half the trouble with doing things for the magic world. It's, at the end of the day, we all need to make a living, pay our bills, and blah, 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 the boring stuff of life.
Right.
But also at the end of the day, that you do have to make a living, and much as it's lovely to do things like conventions and magic lectures and these things like the Real Magic and indeed your podcast stuff, you also have to be very aware of the fact that that isn't going to make you a living.
Exactly. That's just
kind
of...
Sometimes it is tying down the time, you know.
It is. It's kind of guns or butter. You can do one or the other, and this is really not something, I say this, you know, things that within the magic community, there are very few people who are making a living from selling things or doing things for magicians, you know. Mike Amar and Daryl, you know, and a couple of others that have a lot
and
of things.
Especially if you don't have a magic shop, you know, and that would be like Daryl, Mike Amar. I'm trying to think of some of the other...
Jay Sankey.
Mm-hmm.
Jay Sankey and some others, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Sankey, yeah, he's always putting out tons of stuff. Yeah, but there's a handful of them that do it, but, man, they have to work real hard to turn a buck in
exactly.
doing that.
Exactly, that's right. Well, one of the things that you've been doing for a long number of years, I know, has been the Strange and Unusual Hobbies show, I believe. Is that the title of the show?
Yes, sir. That's, when I get back to it, I'm sure you'll explain why I'm away from it in a moment. Mm-hmm. When I get back to it, I will be, I think it's 9th year.
Ninth year.
And also, of course, I'm still advising the television show White Collar, which should be going into season 6 this summer coming up. And really recently, I've been, I'm sure you know, because you keep on top of these things, you're like, Jessica Fletcher of Magic. It's not Murder, She Wrote, it's Mystery, She Wrote. It's your thing.
Yes.
I've been doing a lot more of the acting side. Just finished a little short movie called Redemption, where I play the devil. And the next one up is an HBO one, where I play a mad psychiatrist.
I'm saying you're getting typecast in those kinds of roles, devil and a mad scientist.
Yeah, and the mad psychiatrist, but it's fun. It's much more fun than you think. I mean, very long hours and all that stuff, but just great fun.
Now, are you on the set, going back like to White Collar, for an example,
on and off.
Mm-hmm. Are you mostly
writing, advising from home, but if they need Matt or Tim or Willie to do, or indeed one of the other actors, to do something sneaky or finickety or whatever, I go down to the set and teach them how to do it. And it's not a question of just teaching them how to do it, actually. It's a case of often designing the whole thing from scratch because they don't have 20 years to practice.
But
they've
got
like 20 minutes tops to get it. So you have to redesign a pickpocket or a lockpick so that it looks like they've spent 20 years learning it, but actually they've spent about 3 minutes and then practiced it a couple of times.
And didn't you tell me that Matt is pretty good, the star of White Collar, is pretty quick
he's getting very good at pickpocketing, especially. And his lockpicking skills are getting much better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, he takes it very seriously, as does Tim, actually. Both of them are very proud of the fact they can do some of these sneaky little things now. And Matt's been learning a couple of card tricks, like little betcha, gambling card tricks and things.
Yeah, it seems like
on his actor buddies.
I saw something on one of the recent episodes. I thought he was doing some sort of it wasn't a three-card Monty, but it was some sort of a scam. And I thought, there's Siamese influence I could see right there.
Oh, yeah. No, it's they give me a pretty long rope to play around with when it's one of those kind of scenes.
So they
play most of the language, the criminal kind of language for them and stuff like that.
Now, what do they do? Come to you with just a general idea, we want to stick something in here, and what do you think, or do they have a specific idea?
It happens in a number of ways. One way is before the start of the season, or certainly in the seasons I've been working on so far, I'll get emails saying, and I don't get the story at this point, they'll just say, how would you get this out of here? How would you smuggle this through an airport? How would you convince this person to do that? You know, body language stuff and body mirroring stuff. But during the closer to the season, and then, of course, during the filming of the season, I get the pre-script, which is like the proposal script, go through that, do my advising on that. Then I'll get the updates on the script and just keep advising on those. And if it's something very important, you know, we'll have like a conference call or something like that. So that's it really. Yeah, so two ways. They'll ask me general things, and then closer to it, I start getting specific scripts and so on to advise on.
I assume at this point there really isn't any end in sight. I mean, I know for one of my other favorite shows on the USA Network was Burn Noticed, which has ended. But I assume at this point that White Collar is going to continue to go on for quite some time.
Well, I certainly don't see how they could. I mean, I know I'm one of the few. Well, I'm one of the few people in the whole mob here that knows how this season ends, and it would. I can tell you it would be very difficult to just end it at the end of this season.
Yeah.
It's a real, oh my God, moment for the fans.
It is a very, very good series. Well, back on your other show that you're doing for the live show off Broadway that is into its ninth year, I've got a question just about how that you not only develop the show, but I guess, do you keep it fresh? Do you keep adding new things, or is it the same show that you've been doing for 9 years? Or tell me something about that.
It's certainly changed over the 9 years. And to compare it from the very first time we did it to how it is now, it's completely different. You'd be hard-pushed to find anything the same.
Mm-hmm.
I don't deliberately put new things in. They just kind of come in by themselves, and the other bits go out by themselves. I think if you do a show that long, it becomes almost as if it has a life of its own, and it's like a child. You're just there to guide it, be the symbiote for making it go to the audience, if you like. But the show actually becomes almost like an entity of itself. And you'll find yourself like thinking, oh, I'll just put that bit in there, and it fits. And then other times something will be on the table, like a little prop thing or a joke thing, and I'll have it there and been using it for months, and then all of a sudden I'll stop using it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't do it particularly consciously, but I'm sure there's some subconscious thing going on there doing that. So, yeah, it's a long answer to a short question, but... Yeah, it does change, and I do tend to read newspapers on the way in and throw in stuff that's apropos to that day's news, and that keeps it very fresh.
So you do try
but
to keep
in terms of
topical.
In terms now of magic, there's very little magic in it, to be honest. But in terms of, like, magic-y, gambly stuff, that stays pretty static. It's just all the BS around it tends to grow and evolve as well.
So do you consider it kind of a comedy show more than a magic show?
Well, it's certainly not a magic show. And anyone who wants to come and watch a magic show is going to be thoroughly disappointed.
Hmm.
It's the story of a con man. And I teach the audience bar bets and things, how to cheat their friends the next day to get their ticket money back. So it's certainly not a magic show. I like to think it's funny, but I also like to think it's kind of entertainingly educational as well. In that we are giving, you know, I'm giving real advice on how to avoid being conned. I'm giving real advice on how to make a few bucks yourself conning people.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, hopefully it's funny. I don't really put it into comedy or magic in that case. I see it more of as a theater piece rather than anything else.
Now, do you bring in some of the White Collar references? In other words, of saying that as far as adding to your credentials, so people are coming that you say, well, here is something that I had taught some of the actors on White Collar or whatever.
Well, I don't do that because that's just not my kind of scene to do that. But the guy who introduces me certainly makes sure they know, you know, some of the stuff I've done, and White Collar is one of the things they mention. I've never been one of those. Well, you know me well enough, Scott. I've never been one of those guys that promotes back of room sales or promotes what I've done. I'd rather the audience just sat and enjoyed what I'm doing at that point.
I know that, but I wanted to hear you say that so the rest of the listeners could hear that from your lips then also. But yes, I do recognize that. And I think it's important, though, that someone, when they do announce you, certainly give your credentials, which are far-reaching. You know, you've got a couple of, more than a couple, books that are out, but you had a follow-up to your Simon Says, I think. Did you have a Simon Says 2, I believe? Wasn't that the one?
Yes, Son of Simon Says, yeah. And there is a Grandson of Simon Says, although it's not out yet. It's finished, it's just not out yet.
Okay, that was my question. I was wondering if there was going to be a third to this trilogy here.
Yeah, no, I've got it finished at home. It's just it's a case of when it gets published and when it comes out. Yeah. Although in the meantime, the Mayor Yedid did a beautiful new version of the Second Deal book, which looks absolutely gorgeous, with photographs instead of drawings. And oh, blimey, I think the feds are here to get me. Hang on, I'll just distract them by waving a small ferret about.
Okay.
Wave, wave. Oh, good, they missed me. yeah, it's... what the hell was I talking about? Oh, yeah, so he's done a great job on Second Deal book, and he's also publishing early next year a big book, an encyclopedic book on Barbet called Betcha, which also includes all the details of how to hook somebody into the bet, how to cool them off, what you have to do to become a mini hustler, and also about 140, 150 different kinds of bets. Some of which you'll know, some of which I'll get you on.
That's a hardcover book?
I don't know how he's going to put it out. I'm guessing he's going to put it out soft cover.
Okay, now, because you've already got one out. Nice. You have one out that says the, it's not the Betcha, but it's a Scoundrels and Con book. What is the one?
How to Cheat at Everything.
How to Cheat at Everything. So this will be a supplement to that, or completely different?
It's kind of, it was a more specialized area. You know, How to Cheat at Everything has everything in it. You know, carnivals, street hustles, Monty, chefs, cards, dice, bloody blinking blah. Whereas this one is specifically just those little bets at the bar, you know, I'll bet you $5 or I'll bet you a beer kind of little bets.
Right, right. And so those projects are kind of in the mill, that the one is just out on the Second Deal, and then the other one, which do you think that may be out by Christmas of next year?
I certainly hope so. It'd be nice. But especially publishing paper these days, you know. I'm not a big fan of the internet because I believe it's taking away reality from us all. But paper books, real books, in other words, are becoming much harder to pitch and sell these days to publishers because the buy on them is so small. All it takes is somebody to buy one, scan it, put it up on the internet, and you've lost 3/4 of your market. You know,
just like that. That's true. Well, a way to combat that, I would think, might be just to release it as an ebook to begin with, in conjunction with the hard copy. I have a fellow I'm going to be talking with here in the next week or two, who has just published a book about magic. I think it's called The Ambitious Card, is the name of his book. It's a mystery, but he has released it both as a hardback book or paperback, as well as an ebook. And it's significant.
Yeah, you know, I can see the exact point of doing that, Scott. But on the other hand, if I did that, I'd almost be kicking myself in the butt, wouldn't I, by saying I hate ebooks. I think they're destroying the whole world of real books, which is what I love. And then I release an ebook. I mean, that's a little. The word hypocritical seemed to creep in there just to make a few bucks, you know.
Yeah,
I'd rather stand by my guns and put it out as a book and say to kids who moan and whine about why magic books and DVDs are so expensive, well, here's a little word for your podcasters out there, and I'm sure none of them are to blame for this, but the people that do the copying, the people that do put it out for fluffins on the internet, it's their bloody fault why these things are so expensive, because you have to make a quick kill on it, because 3 days later, you're not going to make any money off them. You want DVDs to go down? You want magic books, proper books to go down? Stop freaking copying them and start supporting the people that work their butts off to put it out for you.
Right. Well said. I think there is certainly a lot to that. It's the same thing like with tricks that someone would come out, they've done all the research and development, and then they're trying to make something back on it. Again, like we were talking about earlier, not going to make a living off of selling, you know, some trick that you've come up with. But a lot of people say, well, I can make that, or I know, you know, and once they learn this, that's why a lot of magic shops, I remember seeing signs saying that the trick is told when the trick is sold. Because if you tell them beforehand, they're going to say, oh, I got it. Thanks a lot. See you later. And they go home and put it together or whatever.
Yeah. And you've also got this whole thing of, you know, I'm not downing people. Well, I am a bit, but I mean, I'm not trying to sound as though everybody's to blame. But you do, there's a whole slew of people who'll go into their brick and mortar magic shop, ask to see a demonstration of a new trick, watch the demonstration, go home and order it off the internet to save a few dollars rather than support their brick and mortar magic store.
Well, I've heard that from many dealers who will tell me that they've come in and they take a look at something, and they may even go to the extent of taking a picture of it with their phone and then going back and looking, or even scanning the barcode, you know, and then looking right there online to see where it is. You know, that Emery Williams with Williams Magic Company out in Tucson had combated that some years ago by having a computer back in the back. And so when someone either looked like they were doing that or flat out said, I think I can get that cheaper online, he'll say, well, where is it? You know, or let's go online. And he would walk over to the machine and they would, you know, look it up, and that, you know, may or may not be able to have it at a price. Cause what he would do is to match it. Cause he'd say, well, this is going to be costing so much for shipping and everything then too, which is going to end up costing you more than what you can buy here. Plus you have the immediacy, of course, of purchasing it. But, moreover, rather than, you know, losing the sale right then, is that he could match it, you know, just based upon, you know, what, is being offered on the internet. And I say that was a good strategy, but he no longer has the magic shop.
It is a good strategy, but it's a shame he has to do that.
Yes.
Because it's going to kill his business in the end.
And that's exactly what happened.
They don't have to pay heat, rent, lighting, stuff.
Right.
You know, cleaning, you know, blah, blah, blah. These kids just have, if half of them don't have any stock at all.
Right.
An order comes in, they phone up their suppliers, and the supplier sends it out for them.
Yeah. Well, ultimately,
you know, and that's what's going to kill a brick and mortar store is having to match prices.
And I think that may have been, perhaps I said it was a good idea, but the Williams Magic Shop is no longer in business. That it sold out, and he's got just a, you know, of course, an online presence, but now he has it in a truck that he drives around, you know, to places and showing this. But, you know, how do you go about, you know, embracing modern technology, and, you know, it's, you and I are holding on to some of these older things, like books, for an example, the hardcover. I love my library. I go up and look through it almost daily, you know, for reference.
Yeah.
It's easy to pull something
down. Yeah, I like the smell of a book, you know.
That's the word.
You
I like the smell.
Never seen anybody, you know, you can have 500 books on a tablet-y thing or whatever, or a Wiggle or whatever they call those, a Kindle thing.
Yeah.
But I don't want that. I find it very sterile to look at something like that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, on the computer, when the white collar thing is a good example, they'll email me the script, which is a television script, 42 minutes, it's about 65 to 70 pages. And I'll print it off, I'll hard copy print it off. I won't read it on the computer because I find it really irritating. I like being able to take a book to bed with me. And I have to look for an electric plug, or, you know, if the software is going to work, or all that stuff.
Yes.
You know, and you got the smell of the book. I love old books, that lovely smell of history about them, you know.
I know
whose
exactly.
Whose hands has this book been in?
Yeah. You know, my younger son is much like both of us as well. Nick, and Nick says, you know, he carries around with him just a little notebook, and he said, this is my computer, because it's not going to crash, you know, I won't have to reboot it, I know exactly where it is, I, you know, put these notes in it, and so it's always going to be there, and he just carries it around with him, you know, so.
Yeah, well, so I've got my little old phone book, it's like about, I don't know, maybe 5x8, something like that, loads of pages, they're all falling out, there's bits of paper in there, bits of cardboard, rubber bands holding it together. That's as close to an iPad as I'm ever going to get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But on the other hand, I agree that you need to embrace technology in order to reach more, well, not, if not potential customers, at least make more friends and to have more far-reaching influence, much like the podcast here. You know, if it was just like you and I have done for so many years, just, again, sitting around the pub and talking about theory, and some of my best conversations in life have been just with you just chatting about stuff, and you've had a heavy influence on me. But
well, there's your career down the pan then.
And I remember on more than one occasion in which you had said, you know, I think that this would be the stuff of which lectures should actually be made, in which that if you and I just sit and chat about what we just talked about for the last 2 hours, if others would have been listening, then I think they would have gained from the knowledge that we were talking about here, because we may not have actually pulled out a deck of cards and done one trick for a couple of hours. And that's what kind of inspired me to start doing some of those talk shows that you've helped me with at some of the conventions and things like that.
That was great fun.
But my point is just about this podcast. You know, that's, again, kind of been an inspiration of trying to put these things together so that way that whenever that I am talking with somebody, that it's not just one-on-one and I'm trying to, help magic or further our craft one person at a time, but try to do it thousands at a time with one podcast, you know, like we're doing
here.
Yeah,
no, I totally dig what you're doing here, Scott. But just one point as well on what you just said earlier, I think that the least important thing about magic is doing tricks. I'd love to have the day when a club or a convention said, can you come and do a lecture, but don't do any tricks in it. Just talk about what makes stuff magical. You know, what's the difference between magic and tricks? What's the difference between a guy who can do tricks and a magician? Because huge differences. I mean, monumental differences.
I agree. And I think that...
But nobody will want to watch it because
right.
The problem is that everybody just wants to learn pretty little tricks.
Right. And
this
they
is why the most successful lecturers are those that go out and say, there's a trick, blah-de-blah-de-blah, $10. There's a trick, blah-de-blah-de-blah, $15. There's a trick, blah-blah-blah, $4. And they've just got piles and piles of little envelopes. And sure, that's all well and good for the little hobbyist guy who's just going to fiddle around in his mum's basement and never show them to anybody. But for somebody who's actually serious about wanting to be a performing magician, probably the worst place to try and learn how to do that is at a convention or a magic club.
At a lecture, a typical lecture. I agree with you. I had learned the hard way when one of the early lectures that I had given, that the first half of the lecture was basically theory. I think I may have taught one, possibly two tricks, but for like the first hour, again, it was theoretical types of stuff about theater and character development, presentation and mm-hmm. business, and trying to find a venue for restaurants and different kinds of things. And then when we took a break to sell a few things, Kathy was working in the back of the room, and then she came to me and said, these guys are going to be leaving. They want to learn tricks, you know, and then they want you to do more things. So the second part was full of just trick after trick, you know, and then I have, again, since learned that far and away, the majority of people, 80% or more of those who attend lectures, just as you say, want to take home something that they can do that night, you know, and have something that they can put in their drawer, I guess, to say, yep, I got one of those. You know, sell.
Oh yeah, I mean, and we've all done it, Scott. I mean,
myself included.
When I first moved to America, I sold a lot, and I was amazed. I went into this room where I'd just, you know, been storing stuff over the years. I'd go to convention, get a couple of things, throw them in a drawer, and I thought, oh, I'll get rid of that before I move to America. I walked in there, I mean, there were cupboards full of stuff everywhere, and the sad thing was, half the stuff I had no idea what it was.
Mm-hmm. Just like 10 cards and 9 of them are blank, and it's like it was a great trick at the time, but there are no instructions. What was this?
Because you always lose the instructions. That's the first thing I lose.
Well, I sometimes do that intentionally too, Simon, because I like to try to come up with my own presentation. The idea being, well,
that's a great idea.
You know.
Yeah, throw the instructions to one side the first time you get a problem. Just look at it and think, what can I do with this?
Mm-hmm.
That's always a cool thing to do.
Now you're leading me into another conversation I wanted to have with you about creativity. I always like to find out from people, what is it that is their creative spark? And that just what we're talking about, you buy a trick, throw away instructions, and you figure out how else can this be done? Is there another method or something?
I do that method. One of my other methods is if I see a prop, and so often it's not a magic prop, but it might end up being a magic trick. I love junk stores, you know, the dollar stores and things like that. So I'll buy something. I'd like the mice. I bought this thing that was three woolly mice in a little box. And I just thought it was stupid. And I like stupid things. And one of my recent purchases was the unemergency inflatable chicken.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And what I'll do, I'll just put it on the floor somewhere in my apartment where I'm more than likely to tread on it or trip over it, especially at night. So mm-hmm. It's right in the middle of the carpet somewhere in a route that I walk a lot. And in the end, I get so irritated by tripping over this thing that some area of my brain, or what little is left of my brain, starts thinking about something I can do with it so I can get it off the floor and out the way. So it's another technique I use. The irritation creativity factor, I guess you could call that. And sometimes, of course, there's those joyous moments where you see something and you think, that is perfect for me, and it will fit straight in. You know, all it needs is running in time. A little bit of practice time, get it together, get the storyline nice, but I can see exactly where it'll fit and it's perfect. Tragically, those moments are rarer than frog's hair. Mm-hmm. But they do happen from time to time.
Just kind of a flash of inspiration. But where you wake up in the middle of the night or something, say, oh, I could do this or that. But do you see something and then you build on that, or do you come up with a completely new concept, or do you just happen to be playing?
Yeah, no, absolutely, Scott. I mean, I'll get a trick, even if it's a really crap trick. In fact, I like crap tricks because that means less people are buying it and less likely to do something with it.
Right.
And just fiddle and mess around with it and often end up with something that's so far removed from the original that you wouldn't recognize it at all. But without that little, Zygopian spark at the start, well, that was a $20 word. I wouldn't have had that moment of being able to take it into the next area that it's ended up in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people say, how do you get inspired by stuff? The secret is simple. If you want to do good magic tricks or invent good magic routines, just let everything inspire you and influence you. Don't just read magic books and don't just look at tricks that are out there. Let everything inspire you. Go to musical theatre. Go to comedy. Smell roses. Listen to people in the street. Watch people. Visit museums. Yeah, anything. Let everything influence you, and you'll be amazed at some of the ideas you come up with.
I think that's true, that too many people would stay just in their own little world, almost literally, and never leaving the house. And just there is something to certainly the repetitiveness and working on something, but you can do that while you're watching television as far as practicing
sure.
Double lift or whatever. But the rest of the time, you should be getting out and about and having conversations with other people and knowing what's going on. Just as you said that you take the newspaper and take a look to see what topical things you can discuss with your show in order to keep that fresh, you know, every Saturday night.
Sure. And there's only one way to learn how to perform, Scott. You're smart, you know this. There's only one way to learn how to perform, and that's to go out and perform.
Do it. Mm-hmm.
You can read all the books you want in the world about it, but it isn't going to make you a performer. But people generically are frightened of performing because they think they're going to be bad. Well here's a newsflash for all of our podcasters. Everybody's bad when they start performing. I can have nightmares about early shows I did as a kid that were so ghastly, I'm amazed the audience let me live and leave. But that's true of everybody. But the more you do it, the better you get. And that's the only way to learn to perform is to go out there and do it. Forget the books on performance. I think they're about as useful as a cat flap in an elephant house at the zoo. Completely pointless. You've just got to get out there and do it over and over and over again. You know, I could give you 25 books on brain surgery. You could read them all, know them word for word. Would I let you operate on my brain? Like bugger I would. But you know everything about it. It doesn't mean you can do it.
Right. Well,
if that makes any sense.
No, it makes perfect sense, because the two things that you cannot practice, all you can practice all that you want in front of a mirror or on your own or wherever, but it's timing and misdirection that you can only get once that you're actually in front of an audience. So this way that you know how to do your timing, the pacing to have it proper for that trick, and when are the proper moments to find the misdirection points, because you may think, okay, well, I can misdirect a person here whenever I look up or I say this line or I move my hand, and quite the contrary is true, that you might find in actual practice whenever that someone's really burning your hand, and so you find those things out in actual performance, and you are going to be bad a few times you do it. You're going to get burned early on, and
sure,
so
but that's how you learn how to not be burned.
Exactly, and I think that's true of life of anything. I think that you talk about brain surgery, that I'm sure that, you know, surgeons probably start on, you know, much smaller monkey brains or something. I don't know, you know, so this way that rather than on human beings, but they have to be bad someplace, you know.
Sure.
You know.
Absolutely.
I think nurses give needles to, you know, shots to oranges or something to kind of learn how to break the skin or something, you know, kind of work their way up. And I'm sure that they probably killed a lot of oranges on the way doing it wrong.
Oh, yeah. Middle. And, you know, like surgeons practice on cadavers, of course.
Mm, right. So anyhow, I agree. You have
to get that little dead body.
Unless you're going to be getting it on YouTube. Now, there's another thing. You know, it seems like a lot of people who are not performing in front of people end up performing for thousands or maybe hundreds of thousands, depending upon how many hits they get on YouTube, but they're just doing it for themselves.
Yeah.
And you know,
yeah, I was going to say, that is not performing, though.
Right, right.
Anybody, you know, that's why lots of agents these days, you know, like if you're semi-auditioning for a live gig and you've got your show tape, you know, you're ideally your 2-3 minute show reel that you send in to them that's beautiful and nicely cut. Lots
right.
of agents won't even bother to look at them these days that I know, because anybody can do a perfect show reel. All you got to do is do it enough and cut it together properly. You know, that's like when people say, how do you always do the acting bits in on television so well? How do you always manage to do the tricks so perfectly on the magic DVDs? Well, it's because you can do them 50 times and choose the best one.
Yeah. Well,
you know, but that's not life performing. Life performing is a whole different ballgame.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to do it, and you've got to stand your ground and do it. And even if you mess up, you've got to then get out of it. That's the most important thing to practice, in my opinion. Once you practice the trick, the only thing you really need to practice after that is what happens if it goes wrong. Because I don't care who you are, you can be the best anything on the planet, but sometimes it's going to go wrong.
Well, you've got a good point as far as like the video reel that people are going to be looking for. When I first started working cruise ships, the first thing they said is we really don't want a best of reel. We need to have actually just a live 30-minute show, something showing from start to finish, because they want to look at the overarching, the whole part of the show, because just as you say, that you can edit anything to make it look great, certainly, but they want to see where are the highs and lows. Is it constantly high? Is it building? Is it a good, is it an entertaining show? And
sure.
So, you know, that's important that people have those kinds of reels available. If you're going to be wanting to work for an agent, and I'm not talking about a party planner, but someone who is an agent who works for you, which is completely different from a party planner, which is a whole different subject.
So more of a manager than an agent, even, is what you're talking about.
Correct. And again, that's what they would do for cruise ships, you know, that are booking agents for cruise ships, that they do want to see that. They want to know, because their reputation is on the line as well, trying to recommend someone. And again, you know, after 20 or 30 takes, you can have a great tape eventually, you know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a crazy world, Scott, and we all just have to survive in it the best we can.
Yes.
So instead of doing show reels, just get some naked pictures of yourself standing on top of a small tortoise called Henry and call your act, I Bet You'll Never Guess What I Do for the Finale.
Was that the chicken I heard in the background there?
You know, it's just my lunch being delivered, old chap.
Oh, okay. Very well.
Don't worry, I'm not in my mansion with servants. I am in a place where they do serve you lunch at the moment, though.
They bring you things. Well, that was kind of a point I was wanting to get to as well, that I wanted to make this quite topical and talking about the newspapers and everything, that I had just learned that this week that you had suffered a rather horrific accident, and I know that a lot of people have heard bits and pieces, bits and bobs about what actually happened, but can you tell us a little bit about exactly what happened?
Sure. I'd just done my Saturday night show. I got back home. I should caveat this, by the way, for anyone that actually listens to bland rumors about my evil reputation. I was stone cold sober and was actually looking forward to sitting down watching some TV and having a nice cold beer, to be honest. Put my bag down, turned around to the sofa to pick something. I turned around, sorry, to the sideboard to pick something up that I wanted. And the area rug under my foot suddenly twisted, and I managed to hurtle to the floor as it skidded away from underneath me. Kind of fall that any normal guy would just get up from 99% of the time and go, oh, you stupid bugger, and just be irritated by it. Unfortunately, if you've seen those adverts, I've fallen and I can't move, that was me. I'd managed to fall the one way to do the maximum damage to my femur, which is the biggest bone in the human body, and I've managed to break it in three places.
Wow.
So it's a very, very, very bad break indeed. It's whole legs being held together by titanium rods, and now it's all therapy in the nursing home as they try and get me to walk again. And so far, I've been in just coming up on 4 weeks, I think it is. It might be the anniversary. It's my 4 week anniversary of marrying a nursing home. and they still haven't told me when they're letting me out.
But you had, once you had fallen, you had said that you had not even been discovered for like 16 hours or something.
Right, yeah, because I literally couldn't move. So I couldn't get to a phone or anything. My upstairs neighbor was away. So I literally had to sleep on the floor, wake up and wait to hear noise upstairs for them having returned. And that was, yeah, about 16 hours later, and he came down to find out what the heck I was screaming about. And, of course, that's when he discovered me and instantly called 911.
Right.
And away we go into the wild blue yonder, you know, whoop, 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 and the whole nine yards.
And then once they x-rayed it, they said this couldn't even be cast. It was one of the worst breaks.
Well, they didn't put it into a cast. The guy didn't want to do that, A, because he said it wouldn't do any good, because the leg was so smashed up that it wouldn't do any good at all. So they cut the front of the knee off, put these steel rods or titanium rods up there.
Wow.
Screwed everything into place against the hip and against the broken bits of bone. And that was a 4.5 hour operation, I think, 4 or 5 hours. And then I had another operation on the lower part of the leg. They had to put a steel rod sideways in there to hang weights off to try and straighten the leg a bit more. And then some blood transfusions and loads of injections. Although the good news is I continue to get free morphine.
Now,
it's always a joy.
I recall that you used to walk with a cane from time to time. So was it on that same bad leg that you'd had?
Yeah, and it's quite funny. One of the first therapists I had said, you know, you're probably going to end up with a bit of a limp. I said, well, that'd be good, because I had quite a bad one before.
It's like, can I play the piano?
Yeah, you know, it's like that old joke, isn't it? The kid going into the chemist saying, can I get some tampons, please? And the chemist said, are they for your mother, your sister? He said, no, they're for me. He said, you're a guy. And he says, yeah, I need some tampons. He says, why? He said, well, look at the back. It says, after using these, you can swim, parachute, skydive, bloody, bloody, but he said, and I can't do any of those things.
It will make him an instant superhero, which now you're the titanium man, about the $6 million man or something, huh?
Yeah, I'm 20 bucks short of the $6 million man.
Yeah.
And if you know anything about medical billing, yeah, no, I'm talking about.
I do. You're talking about $1,000 an hour for every hour that you're in the hospital, and so that's no cheap deal for just 4 hours.
Oh yeah,
oh goodness,
it's
sakes,
a
or
lot
more.
Of money.
Yeah, that's right. So you say you're in a nursing home then now, and not back at your home?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I'm in the nursing home right now. They can't let me home because I'm living by myself. There's no way I'd be able to do anything.
Right, and so
and I still have to have intensive therapy twice a day.
Now, with that, does that mean that they have you get up and walking in your wheelchair, I assume, most of the time then now?
Yeah, I've got a wheelchair. They've also had me up in the therapy room on a walking frame because to get this leg going again at any level, they want – it's completely different to how it used to be in the old days where you'd be in a cast for months and then, they'd take it off and your leg would look like a piece of string. Nowadays, with things like this, they just want to get you up and on it as soon as you possibly can, however much weight you can put on it. So they've had me on walking frames. The last couple of days, I've done some little bits with crutches as well.
But the pain must be excruciating.
I certainly wouldn't put it high on my bucket list of things I'd want to repeat, I must admit.
Yeah.
But they time it so that when they give me the morphine about 15 minutes before a therapy session, so it kind of takes the edge off it a bit.
Now, here we are recording this on December the 7th in 2013, and so you said it was about a month ago, around the 7th or so of November, I assume.
Yeah.
And so how much longer do you think that you're going to be there at the nursing home before they release you? Have you got a...
I'm hoping, and that's my aim, is to try and get out by Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor seems to think it's doable, but he's not promising.
Right.
You know, because it would be kind of pointless to go through all of that and then insist on being released early, you know, or release yourself against medical advice, EMA, mm-hmm. And then completely screw the whole thing up again. So I'm as independent as I am, and much as I don't like being told what to do,
right?
This is one of those cases where you really do have to sit back and, you know, and eat crow and do exactly what they tell you to do.
Because you certainly want to get better, as you say, not repeat this certainly again, this experience.
Exactly.
I would imagine that now is a very important time in which you have not only time to reflect and to read some of the books, but you can't have access to the library and take a look at some of the things. But you would probably, you know, like to receive some cards and letters or emails from friends. And so
that's always very sweet.
If they want to contact you, how is it best for people to get in touch with you?
The best way would be by email. I mean, I can only get at it sporadically, like once every other day or something, because they have a kind of universal computer here. I've got my computer, but they don't have Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't get email on my one. But there's in their little recreation area, there's a computer everybody can use that has email on it. So I can check emails there from people. And the email is very easy. It's just simon@simonlovell.com.
Easy enough to find. Yeah, certainly that way as well. I don't think you have a Facebook page, though, do you?
No. No Facebook, no Twittery, none of that stuff.
Yeah. You're
way
not
too much like hard work.
You're not exactly a Luddite, or else you wouldn't have an email address, and you're using a cell phone and everything else. So, I mean, you do have some advanced technological knowledge. It's just you're not...
Oh, yeah, my cell phone is only 9 years old, by the way.
Is that still the...
It's an old flip phone.
Flip phone? You know, I heard a line...
I can't do texting. I should warn all your buddies that I can't do texting at all. I can't receive them or send them.
Okay, that's important to know, too, because some people might think, well, that's what I'll do then, too. I heard a line on a sitcom the other night that someone, he was looking at somebody with a flip phone. He said, either that person is poor or he's a time traveler.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I must be...
a time traveler.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't paid all the bills yet, so I might be poor as well.
Well, we do wish you the best, and our thoughts and prayers are with you for a speedy recovery and complete then as well.
Thank you, sir.
And in the meantime, as far as your Saturday night shows, the Strange and Unusual Hobbies, obviously that it's a one-man show, and when the one man is not there, there's no show.
Right, yeah, it's been put on hiatus till I get back.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay. As you said, you kind of hinted at it anyway. It's a very good time, actually, because you get lots of free time in these places to reflect, and sometimes some days are good, some days are bad. You know, I'm very honest about that. You know, I've had my depressed down days about this. Mm-hmm. I've had my mad uppity days about it. But it's a good time to reflect about what you're doing. Are you doing the right things, going in the right directions? What are you going to do when you get out? How are you going to change things for the better? Or all that kind of good stuff, you know?
Well,
and sometimes that's a good thing to be able to do in life. It's just stop and have a look at it, smell the roses a bit, and see if you should plant some new ones.
I think that's something that all too few artists in general, not just magicians, but regardless of whatever, and that is of having a long-term business plan of what you want to do, where you want to be in 5, 10, 15 years from now. I mean, uh-huh. It seems that you have had a good path and a good route that you've been following, and so now that you've had even more time to sit and reflect and think about those future things, what are some long-term plans in the life of Simon Lovell?
The new manager's got me, I changed managers. My new manager has me doing a lot more of the acting stuff, which I like very much. So I've been doing some movie things, just played the devil in a movie, a short movie. And then the next one, I think it starts in February, so hopefully I'll be all right for it. It's an HBO thing where I play mm-hmm. a mad psychiatrist, as I told you earlier.
Right.
And then there's a, I also did another one earlier this year where I play an Irish ornithologist, which is quite fun. So more of that, more writing stuff. I do enjoy the script writing.
Do you do much
stuff? Yeah, I mean, I do enjoy that. Some new projects, hopefully with a twist on them that are a little different to the stuff I've been doing in the past.
Do you do much performing before, you know, in private homes and corporate parties and things like that?
Every now and not corporate parties. Well, I haven't done one in years, but I don't say I wouldn't do one.
Mm-hmm.
I did a couple of private home parties in October, I think it was, mm-hmm. but not much. I mean, it's not through not wanting to. It's just people don't really see me as that kind of performer, I guess.
Right, and that's not something that you're pushing or trying to solicit.
It's not something I push at all, no.
Right, so if it comes your way, fine, but really more of the acting and writing is what you're all about.
Yes, sir, mm-hmm. and having a beer with this guy called Scott Wells, who I quite like.
And ditto. Always some of my best times, as I said. Well, that's great. Well, I'm glad that you are on the mend, at least, and it sounds like you're in good hands, and I'm probably interrupting your luncheon right now.
That's all right. It's hospital food. How much can you interrupt anything?
I guess that's Jell-O. It'll keep, right?
No, that's what we got today. Actually, most of the food here is pretty good. We've got a reasonable-looking hamburger, chips, lettuce, tomato, ice cream. Yeah, it's not bad. It's all right.
No cold draft beers.
Kill me.
No cold draft
beers.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, it won't kill you and make you stronger, so you should be strong.
Exactly, sir.
Good.
And anyway, the morphine will take the taste off.
Well, thank you very much for being on the Magic Word here today. It's always a delight to talk with you. And so I know how.
As we're going to an end, I'll tell you a joke that involves a magician and a nursing home, and it's not about me.
Okay.
This local magician, he's somehow got it into his head. He's a big star in this town. You know, he's been in the local paper. They give him like a little quarter of a page thing, something mm-hmm. he did for charity. He was on the local news for about a minute. And he does a couple of little gigs at his friends' restaurants and stuff. So he's convinced now that Vegas is just a phone call away and everybody knows who he is and he's a big star. So he goes down the local nursing home. He says to his friend, he said, I'll go down there, give the old biddies and stuff, give them a thrill when they meet a proper celebrity. He goes all around the nursing home. They're all completely ignoring him. Nobody's got any idea who he is. And he walks up to this old bloke in a wheelchair and he says, excuse me, do you know who I am? And the old guy looked up and said, no, I don't. But if you ask at the front desk, they may be able to help you.
That's a good one.
Funny enough for you?
That's a good one to end on. I do like that. Very funny.
Okay, I'll get you a T-shirt that says on it, who is Scott Wells?
Who is... I'm wondering who he is myself.
Exactly. He's a maniac, but we love
him. Well, I know how you're going to be spending your holiday, and I know it could be. It's better if you're going to be spending it at home.
The nurses have phoned you up and told you. The nurses have been informed on our Bahamas trip.
Yes, they told me that they have something planned for you that should be special.
Oh yes,
something about a bath. But anyhow.
We love you a long time, Mr. Simon.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. And I wish you a Merry Christmas, buddy. And thanks a lot.
You too. And of course, Merry Christmas to all your podettes out there.
And to all a good night over there. So that was Simon. That was Simon Lovell for the Magic Word podcast. For the Magic Word podcast, this is Scotty out.